The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Joe Biden's gun baloney, the juicy stuff Hunter Biden left out of his memoir. And the founder of the Babylon Bee, the great satirical site, joins me. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
I wanted to talk about Joe Biden's view of the Constitution and specifically about the Second Amendment. Now, Biden recently released an executive order. The executive order has a series of measures. One of them is he's trying to stop, apparently, these ghost guns, which are guns that are assembled at home from the parts of the guns, and they don't have a serial number. There's a bunch of other measures. He wants a report on gun trafficking. He wants to get suggestions for red flag legislation on guns. But interestingly, in the course of presenting this executive order, first of all, Biden started out with a big whopper. He goes, you know, you can go to a gun show, you can buy whatever you want, no background checked. Turns out that's not true. Jen Psaki was asked about it, the press secretary, and she goes, no, that's actually not the president's belief. And of course, a number of the fact-checking sites have had to kind of grudgingly say that Biden's statement is false. But what's most interesting about what Biden said is his view of the Constitution. Here's the key part of that. Listen.
Nothing I'm about to recommend in any way impinges on the Second Amendment. They're phony arguments suggesting that these are Second Amendment rights at stake from what we're talking about. But no amendment to the Constitution is absolute. You can't yell fire in a crowded movie theater. We call it freedom of speech. From the very beginning, you couldn't own any weapon you wanted to own. From the very beginning of the Second Amendment existed, certain people weren't allowed to have weapons. So the idea is just bizarre to suggest that some of the things we're recommending are contrary to the Constitution.
Now, the weird thing about this is, I don't think Biden is speaking off the cuff. I think he's reading from a prepared statement. Does no one check this stuff? No amendment to the Constitution is absolute. Really? How about the 13th Amendment? This was the amendment, by the way, that ended slavery. It permanently banned slavery in America. Not absolute? What? Should we have some form of slavery back now? Are there some exceptions to the rule? Are there certain people who are allowed to be enslaved under certain conditions? No. 13th Amendment is absolute. But what about the other amendments? Now, it's true that there are some conservatives who have been saying about Biden, he doesn't care about the Constitution, the Second Amendment is absolute. Here's a tweet, the Constitution is absolute and can't be violated with an executive order and so on. Now, I think when you think about it, and Biden himself gives an example, constitutional provisions are not all of them anyway, in fact, absolute. Now, what about the exceptions to the First Amendment? Just to help us think about this. There are certain things you can't say, and I can think of three concrete examples. Here's something that you can't say that it would be unlawful to say. And that is to say to a politician, I'll give you a whole bunch of money if you give a tax break to my business. That's bribery. Now you might say, well, it's free speech. I have a right to say whatever I want. But no, bribery is in fact illegal. You can be punished for that. Here's something else you can't say. You can't threaten the life of the president. That's speech, but you can't say it because it's interpreted as a threat of violence. And you will be arrested So that is speech that you can't say. And of course, Biden gave the famous example, you can't shout fire in a crowded theater. Now, if you think about these examples for a minute, the first one and the second one are not allowed because they pertain to actions. So the bribery itself has to do with the actions that are illegal. It's illegal to exchange a favor for money. And because the action is illegal, the plan, the stated plan to execute the action, is also illegal. The same with the threat. The illegal act is actually the violence against the president. Now, if you are in some confined circumstance, let's say you are locked up, for example, in an asylum, you're absolutely off your rocker, and you threaten the life of the president, but there's nothing you can do, there's no way you could carry it out, probably people would just ignore you. The guy's a kook. The threat is only meaningful to the degree that you actually might be able to carry it out. And when we think about the example of shouting fire in a crowded theater, well, first of all, if there is a fire, you're allowed to warn people. Obviously, you don't want to shout it in a manner that causes a stampede. And again, right there is the problem with the shouting fire. It's the stampede and the panic that poses a risk to people's safety and to their lives. Now, a First Amendment absolutist might say, wait a minute, the First Amendment doesn't say anything about these exceptions. It just says Congress shall make no law restricting freedom of speech or the press. It doesn't say with the exception of shouting fire in a crowded theater. But the point I'm trying to make is that these exceptions, when you think about them, these ways in which the First Amendment is not absolute, all pertain to the fact that there is no legitimate, conceivable purpose for this speech, except to produce, you may say, a harmful action. So why would anyone want to shout fire in a crowded theater when there's no fire, except to cause harm? There's no purpose to be served other than that anyway. Now, applying this logic to guns, when you think about guns, if you could find weapons, and you can find them, by the way, in which there would be no conceivable purpose for any individual or private entity to own them. So I can think of some examples. I can't think of any conceivable purpose why, for example, I or you or any other private individual would want to have a nuclear bomb. So for us, having nuclear bombs and preventing us from getting our hands on a nuclear bomb does not contravene the Second Amendment. Similarly, let's say, for example, I had the know-how and had assembled a team to build biological weapons in my basement. Biological weapons that could unleash, for example, deadly chemicals or deadly viruses that could wipe out a substantial portion of the population. Again, there's no conceivable purpose for me to do that. I don't need that to defend myself, for example. It's not part of my needs for, let's say, hunting or sportsmanship. Not at all. But with a lot of these weapons that the Biden administration is targeting, they have legitimate purposes. Legitimate purposes, if not for hunting, then for self-defense. So lawful people can use these weapons in a lawful manner. And I think the point of the Second Amendment is to say, listen, if there is any conceivable lawful purpose for lawful citizens to own these guns in which they can use them in a legitimate way, then you can outlaw them. You can outlaw them because you don't want bad guys to get these guns and use them in a bad way. It's kind of like saying, you know, if you think of the incident in Washington, D.C., where that guy rammed his vehicle into a barricade and killed a cop. You can't say the car did it. Let's outlaw cars. Well, why won't you outlaw cars? We don't outlaw cars because we realize that the problem isn't the car. It was the maniac behind the wheel. And the same is true with these mass shootings. It's the maniac with the gun that is the problem. It's not the gun itself. And that's the root problem, as I see it, with the Biden administration's gun control initiatives, is that they're all targeting the gun in contravention of the Second Amendment, while they pay little or no attention to the guy who's pulling the trigger. I've been talking to Mike Lindell, and this guy is always cooking up new stuff. He's really annoyed at the censorship on digital platforms, as we all are. And he's starting his own. It's incredible. He's going to be launching this in, I believe it's April 19th, so very soon. And I'll have a lot of details for you about it. It's called Frank. And I guess it means we can speak frankly. We can speak in an uncensored manner. We can have the free speech that we don't have on so many of the other platforms. So very exciting news. I also want to talk about Mike's products. He's always putting out new ones and great ones. His newest one, slippers. My slippers. Mike has taken over 2 years to develop these amazing slippers. They're designed to wear indoor or outdoor all day long. They're made with MyPillow foam and impact gel to help prevent fatigue. They're made with quality leather suede. For a limited time, Mike is offering 40% off the new My Slippers. They're so comfortable, you'll want to get some, not just for you, for the whole family. Debbie and I got ours. We love them. I got the moccasins. Debbie got the slip-ons. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code Dinesh. You'll get deep discounts on all the other products. The Giza Dream bed sheets, the MyPillow mattress topper, the MyPillow towel sets. Call 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com and use promo code Dinesh. Somebody should tell Hunter Biden how to write a book. Now, Hunter Biden has a new book out. It's called Beautiful Things. And it's got this cute little picture of little Hunter Biden. It's supposed to be kind of one of these tell-all books that gives the full story on Hunter Biden. But the problem with the book is that all the juicy stuff is not in the book. What? What kind of, as an author, I mean, author to author, Hunter Biden, you're going about this the wrong way. If you want to sell a book, the first thing is go for a juicy cover. I mean, here's a picture of you that I pulled right off. I kind of wish I printed this in color. This would have been kind of a cool picture for the cover. You look in a crack-induced, dazed haze. And I know there are lots of other pictures. I mean, there are semi-nude pictures of you, Hunter Biden, or you got a crack pipe, you're lying in a bathtub. I mean, that would be a head-turner at Barnes & Noble. Whoa! And then there's all the great stuff that you've done. See, a lot of people who write books, they write books about themselves, and their lives are really dull. They haven't done anything. They got to scratch their heads like, man, when I was 27, you know, I did this and stuff. And they try to then gin it up to make it exciting. Well, Hunter Biden has lived an unbelievably exciting life. I mean, crack pipes, prostitutes, bribery, all kinds of rackets that you've been up to. I mean, this would have made great reading. Fun stuff. I mean, very interesting. But you decided to leave it out of your memoir. So the memoir that's worth reading is the one you didn't write. Well, fortunately, the guys at the Daily Mail, and see, these days we have to sort of go across the pond. We have to go to Britain to kind of get details. Why? Because we don't have a functioning media. There are literally, there's a cornucopia. The Daily Mail has seen 103,000 Hunter Biden text messages, 154,000 emails, more than 2,000 photos. The American press has access to this, but they're covering it up. In fact, what the American press is doing by and large is just sort of schmoozing Hunter Biden. By the way, I just saw a little clip on Jimmy Kimmel where Hunter Biden is literally being praised because evidently the real nepotism is in the Trump family, whereas Hunter Biden got all that he got because he's amazingly well-qualified. Listen.
Does it make you crazy when you hear someone like Donald Trump Jr. saying that the only reason he does is because he's a Biden and because of his last name and how just wildly comical that is? I mean, does it?
It is wildly comical.
Well, Donald Trump Jr. didn't get $83,000 a month for 5 years from a foreign energy company, Burisma, while his father was in charge of policy dealing with the Ukraine. So don't think the analogy quite applies. Now, let's talk about the stuff that is not in Hunter Biden's book. The first thing that the Daily Mail has done, which I think is very important, is that they have validated that this is Hunter Biden's laptop. Now, you remember Hunter Biden kind of went on television and he goes, yeah, there could be a laptop out there that was stolen from me. It could be mine, but it could be that it was hacked. It could be it was Russian intelligence. It could be it was stolen from me. You know, this is a habitual liar. This guy's probably been lying since he was two. And so the lies just come out of his mouth. And of course, the reporter is like, doesn't follow up. Weren't those your emails? Didn't you write those emails? None of that. Now, the Daily Mail handed the laptop and all the stuff to forensic experts. And the forensic experts, this is a team of forensic experts. They use the same tools as any federal or state law enforcement for criminal investigations. And they go, yeah, you know what? It's Hunter Biden's laptop. Those are his emails. There's absolutely no evidence of fabrication by the Russians or by anyone else. Now, what is it that the media is covering up with regard to Hunter Biden? What's the stuff that he left out of his book? Here's a few sort of little tidbits. Hunter Biden was begging Joe Biden to run for president, in part to salvage his own reputation. Here's an actual text that he sent to his dad. If you don't run, I'll never have a chance at redemption. Very interesting. Hunter Biden basically sees Joe Biden's running as a chance to sanitize his own criminal record, his own sordid sexual history. All of that will be cleaned up because his father will be the president. There will be devotional press coverage. Jimmy Kimmel will call to have him on. And, isn't Donald Trump Jr. the real criminal? Isn't he the real beneficiary of nepotism? And sure enough, it's happening. So Hunter Biden, in that weird sense, was prophetic. We also find on the laptop Hunter Biden having multiple dealings with all kinds of drug dealers and prostitutes. He apparently was in the habit of staging photos with these prostitutes. He would run the video of himself and he'd go back and look at the video. In one case, Hunter Biden left to go to the bank and the cop showed up. And the prostitute texts Hunter Biden, "Did you call the cops on me?" So then Hunter Biden is texting the pimp to say, "Hey, what's happening here? I didn't call the cops. What the heck is going on?" So all of this stuff, all of this juicy stuff, left out of the book. Man, that could have really boosted sales. Hunter Biden decided not to talk about it. He's making porn films with prostitutes. Interestingly, he was guarded by Secret Service agents in 2018 when he was on a massive drug and prostitution binge in Hollywood. Which is very odd because he wasn't really entitled to Secret Service protection. So we see case after case here how evidence of criminal activity, Hunter Biden, there's an actual affidavit where Hunter Biden says, "No, I don't use drugs," and so on, which you have to sign when you buy a gun. So we have, right there is Hunter Biden's signature. It is his signature. He obviously lied. This is a criminal offense, yet there's no hint of prosecution. So Hunter Biden, same thing we saw with the Clintons. These are criminals. But there are criminals who have this sense that they are above the law. They know that the system is engineered for their benefit. They have powerful relatives. In this case, the father, obviously in the Clintons' case, it was Hillary and Bill, who have ways of getting around the law. I think they know that they've corrupted the FBI. The FBI today is not a real FBI. It's essentially an extension of the Democratic. Its main obsession is with tracking down January 6th walkthrough guys. And letting real criminals get away with it. So next time, Hunter Biden, well, perhaps you should do a sequel. You've done a lot of juicy stuff, and you're a thoroughly shameless guy, and that actually can make for a very juicy book. Do you think our nation's economy is going to be insulated from Biden's planned massive tax increases? Think again. There's only one way to protect your savings. Do what over 10,000 other smart investors have and convert a portion of your retirement accounts into gold and silver with Birch Gold. When inflation hits, and it will, gold and silver are your safe haven. And Birch Gold Group is the company I trust to help you convert an IRA or eligible 401k into an IRA backed by gold and silver. Through April 30th, on qualifying purchases, when you buy physical gold or silver or open a precious metals IRA with Birch Gold, they will send you a free home safe. Text Dinesh to 484848 for your free information kit on precious metals IRAs or to speak with a Birch Gold representative today. With 10,000 customers, an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, they can help you too. Text Dinesh to 484848 for your free safe with qualifying purchase. Here's a piece of good news. The San Francisco School Board has suspended its plan to rename a third of all the public schools in San Francisco because evidently the old names were somehow racist. The city's Board of Education voted unanimously to reverse the decision to strip 44 public schools of the names of various historical figures, including Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and the poet Robert Louis Stevenson. apparently a number of parents had complained, school teachers had complained, elected officials had complained. There were some legal challenges, and so they decided to revoke the decision. Now, what's particularly interesting is to watch how this decision got made in the first place, because it kind of shows you the left in operation, how they actually function. The San Francisco School Board, the Board of Education, had created a School Names Advisory Committee in 2018. It was to, quote, engage the larger San Francisco community in a sustained discussion regarding school names. Now, in fact, no such discussion ever took place. Typically, this is all rhetorical cover. Oh, democracy, we're going to consult the people, but the people are never consulted. Pretty soon, the committee decides for the people. And so they decide things like, let's get rid of Abraham Lincoln. And you might think, wait a minute, Abraham Lincoln? Isn't this the guy who issued the Emancipation Proclamation? Isn't this the guy who mobilized the Union Army to end slavery? 4 million slaves were freed as a result of what Lincoln did. And so what could be the offense of Lincoln? Well, it turned out that under the Lincoln administration, the U.S. government was apparently harsh on the American Indians. Now, let's remember, first of all, these weren't directly Lincoln's policies. This is the policy of the Trail of Tears, of relocation of the Indians, displacement. Unjust policies, to be sure, but they go back earlier to Andrew Jackson and Martin Van Buren. So, yes, there was mistreatment of the Indians in the 19th century, but to put this all on Lincoln and blame him for it and ignore all the other stuff that Lincoln did, crazy. Turns out that the San Francisco School Board was also doing, quote, research, and their research, by and large, was driven by two things, Google and Wikipedia. And so they decided, let's look up Robert Louis Stevenson. Probably most of these people had never heard of him. And in one of his poems, which is called Foreign Children, it comes in a collection called A Child's Garden of Verses, he needs to make a rhyme. So instead of doing Japanese, he uses the word Japanese. And he wants to make the rhyme work. This was his crime. He's a racist. He didn't say Japanese. He said Japanese. That's it for Robert Louis Stevenson. He's out. Paul Revere. Why is Paul Revere out? I thought he gave a useful warning. Paul Revere, the British are coming. Turns out Paul Revere was accused of being part of an expedition that stole the land of the Penobscot Indians. Except Revere was not part of that. He didn't do anything to the Indians. He was part of something called the Penobscot Expedition, which was an American military campaign against the British during the Revolutionary War. So in other words, some yahoo, some nitwit, some room temperature IQ San Francisco Board of Education person looked this up, misread what's in Wikipedia, didn't even understand it. Probably a product of the San Francisco public schools themselves. And blames Paul Revere for something he didn't do. So he was unjustly booted. He wasn't even guilty of the crime that he was accused of. Interestingly, there's a school named after Malcolm X. And as part of the discussion, someone said, we can't have Malcolm X. The guy was actually, the guy was involved in drug dealing. He was a pimp. And someone else went, well, yeah, but that was only the early Malcolm X. Later, he actually became a great guy. And everyone's, yeah, absolutely. He's fine. He grew through it. He became enlightened. Interestingly, this notion that one can atone for one's past mistakes, one can learn, one can become a better person, this kind of allowance is not given to anybody else, but it's given to Malcolm X. Ironically, they decided that El Dorado Elementary should also be renamed. Now, El Dorado is, in fact, not a person, and it's not even a place. It's a mythical place. It was an imaginary land which was, in a sense, made of gold. We're trying to find El Dorado, a sort of mythical Eden laden with gold. So why get rid of El Dorado? Apparently, the San Francisco Chronicle reports, one of the board members goes, I don't like El Dorado. I think the concept of greed and the lust for gold, this is a concept that we don't want our children to identify with. So that's it. El Dorado School is out. I think what we're beginning to see here as we kind of look at the sausage making of all this is that these are people who are mindless dummies. They're full of ideological resentment. They're looking to cancel this guy, cancel that guy. But there's no balance. There's no historical knowledge. There's no sense of context. There's no proper research. They don't consult professionals in the field. They don't weigh different points of view. They do none of it. What this really means is that the public school system in San Francisco is being run by Philistines. Look up that word, by the way. You may have to Google it, San Francisco people. I doubt most of you know what it is. They're being ruled by barbarians. Maybe that's an easier one for you to comprehend. And these are the people deciding important things that reflect our public culture and our American civilization. So we're in jeopardy on this one, guys. She's one of the most powerful voices for faith, family, and freedom. Someone I respect, a friend of mine, Candace Owens. Candace has joined the terrific lineup at The Daily Wire, launching a new show where talk show meets late night. She'll continue to call out leftist lies on the corruption of the media and big tech. Join Candace each week as she welcomes powerful voices to talk about the important issues, break down what's actually happening in our country, and trust me, you're going to laugh a lot too. Candace is unfiltered and uncancelable, even as she says all the things others on the right wing are afraid to say. Her full show is available to Daily Wire members only. Use code Dinesh and get 25% off your Daily Wire membership now. Have you heard of the concept of ethnomathematics? Ethnomathematics. Basically, it is a form of mathematics that tries to avoid or get around the racism that is allegedly in normal mathematics. Now you might say, wait a minute, I didn't realize that normal mathematics is racist. Turns out that normal mathematics is, according to the left, not only racist, but it's actually wrong. Normal mathematics is wrong because it doesn't take into account all the different real-world circumstances that this mathematics is supposed to describe. Now, I'm reflecting here the views of a guy, and this is actually a fellow in the Department of Biostatics at Harvard University. His name is Kareem Carr. And he has advanced the idea that 2 plus 2 is in fact 5. Now, you'd be like, wow, you know, too bad Euclid didn't figure this one out. Let's do what mathematicians do and let's see the proof. Well, as you might imagine, the proof turns out to be somewhat suspect. This fellow, Kareem Carr, and a couple of other people like him who are sort of allies of his, this is their type of reasoning. Normal numbers don't always describe the real world. For example, try to imagine two factories, Factory A and Factory B, and each of them are manufacturing circular objects. Well, in Factory A, you have two circular objects and a half circle. And in Factory B, you have two circular objects and a half circle. So, how many circular objects in the first factory? 2. How many in the second? 2. But if you can bring the two factories together, then the half circles will combine to create a full circle. And in that way, 2 plus 2 will give you 5. Here's another winning example. You have a man and a woman who get together, and over a period of time, they have a kid. So 1 plus 1 equals 3. Wow! Now, the first thing we have to say when we listen to this kind of stuff, and, you know, it's unbelievably dumb, I have to admit. Can you imagine going to somebody like Euclid and telling them, 1 plus 1 isn't really 2, because after all, you have a husband and a wife, and they produce a child, and so you got 3. Euclid is not going to go, man, that's my proof has been completely contradicted. I better go back to the drawing board. Everyone has known all this. And it raises the question of what mathematics even is. Now, mathematics is based on abstraction. Many years ago, the philosopher Bertrand Russell and Alfred North Whitehead collectively wrote the Principia Mathematica, the Principles of Mathematics, in which they showed that mathematics is a division of pure logic. And mathematical demonstrations rely on the ability, even the most simple demonstrations rely on the ability for your mind to take something that you can see but abstract from it. Take something really simple like this. How many lines can be drawn between two points in a Euclidean geometry on, let's say, a flat plane? And the answer is one. But if you think about it, it's not really true. If I take a Sharpie and I make a big fat dot over here, and I take the Sharpie and make a big fat dot over here, I can probably draw seven lines in between the two points. Why? Because the dot over here has dimension. And the dot over here has dimension. So I could make thin lines running between the two dots. But the real mathematical point is if I think of a dot as occupying no space, as having no dimensions, as being a mere location, and another dot over here as being a mere location with no width and no breadth, then there is only one line. And the line itself has to be thought of as having no width and no breadth. And that's mathematics. It's the capacity to look at the world and imagine from it these pure entities. Now, why do we do that? Why do we even engage in this kind of imaginary activity? The physicist Richard Feynman explained it very well. I want to read a couple of things that he said. He talks about the fact that the world is divided. He's appealing here to something that the writer C.P. Snow once said, into two cultures. And the two cultures, he says, are really simple. The people who appreciate and understand mathematics and the people who don't. So basically, Feynman is saying is that mathematics is a critically important way to understand the world. Let's say why. He goes, it's too bad that mathematics is hard for some people. Because, says Feynman, I'm quoting him now, if you want to learn about nature, to appreciate nature, it is necessary to understand the language that she speaks in. She offers her information in only one form. Only one form. We are not so unhumble as to demand that she change before we pay any attention. So what Feynman is saying is nature speaks to us in the language of mathematics. And by understanding mathematics, we can then apply it to the world in which we live. Mathematics, in a way, is at first a little startling. In a famous passage, the philosopher Debbie's like, I understand it's been startling for me for a long period of time. Dinesh, you do our taxes. But it was the philosopher Hobbes who looked at the Pythagorean theorem in which in a right triangle, the square of the two sides is equal to the square of the side that joins them, Hobbes was like, there's no way that's true. That's absurd. And so Hobbes followed the proof step by step by step. And he saw that if each of the links in the chain was correct, the conclusion was unavoidable. And this showed Hobbes the beauty and the power of mathematics. So we have to say that given that mathematics is the way that airplanes fly and GPSs work, I mean, try getting to the moon on ethnomathematics. You're not going to do it. I was a little scared when I saw United Airlines that just issued a statement saying that our flight deck should reflect the diverse group of people on board our planes every day. That's why we plan for 50% of the 5,000 pilots we train in the next decade to be women or persons of color. Look, I'm not against hiring women or persons of color, but any airline that uses the slogan, we put diversity first, is an airline that you don't want to fly on. Now, the reason that we're seeing all this nonsense is for one reason alone, and that is that the attack on math is driven by the racially unequal performance of the ethnic groups that do math. Even when you take into account socioeconomic status, Asian Americans and whites, even from families of modest income backgrounds, do better in math than upper middle class Latinos and blacks. And that's the problem right there. And instead of fixing the problem by saying, okay, what can we do to improve our understanding of math, better ways to teach math, better ways to help Latino kids and black kids improve their potential, understand math better, do better on the test. Instead of doing that, it's kind of like saying that baseball is racist. Why? Because Jews and Koreans don't do that well in baseball games. They're underrepresented on the court. We're going to make sure the NBA says that in future, 50% of all the people on the court are going to be Jews and Asian Indians. I mean, nobody does that. Nobody does that. Why? Because the problem isn't with the game. The problem isn't with the height of the net. The problem basically has to do with performance. And that's the same is true with math. Math is actually something that is very important for the world to function. And all that this ethno-mathematics nonsense will do is further hold back, further retard the success of minority groups in doing the one thing that they need to do better in our society. Mike Lindell of MyPillow is kind of an entrepreneur's entrepreneur. It's always fun to talk to him about his business. Here's a short clip of a conversation I had with him. Listen.
Mike, there's a long tradition that goes back to Marx that talks about the entrepreneur as someone who supplies capital. That's where we get the name capitalist, but doesn't really do a whole lot else. And I want to test this theory by talking to a real entrepreneur. So let me start by asking you, do you supply the capital for your business?
Yes, absolutely.
So you started with your own money?
I started with my own money.
And you've funded yourself all the way through?
All the way through.
Yeah, this guy does it all. He puts in the money, he organizes the business, he hires the people, he makes the product, he markets the product. He's kind of a one-man juggernaut. And Debbie and I, we love to have all of Mike Lindell's MyPillow products in our home. We especially love his towels. We're very particular about our towels. We actually want them to dry us. What a concept. MyPillow towels are soft to the touch without the lotiony feel. Proprietary technology makes them highly absorbent. Other towels feel good, but they don't really absorb. MyPillow towels are available in multiple sizes and styles. They're machine washable and durable. 10-year warranty, 60-day money-back guarantee. For a limited time, 2-for-1. Low price and free shipping on the 6-piece sets, and you can save 30% on individual towel options with promo code Dinesh. Call 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com, but make sure to use promo code D-I-N-E-S-H. Dinesh. Folks, I don't know if you're familiar with the Babylon Bee, but it's part of my daily diet of chuckles and laughter and really insight on a daily basis. Me and my friends, we often swap memes from the bee. We talk about the bee. So this is really something that you must be familiar with if you're not already. It's really fun, and it's really penetrating because it gives you sometimes real food for thought. And I'm really delighted to have Seth Dillon, who is the CEO of the Babylon Bee, on the podcast. Seth, welcome. Thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it. Who came up with the wacky idea for the Babylon Bee? How did you guys get started?
Well, thanks for having me, first of all. I'm delighted to be here with you. We got started in 2016 when Adam Ford, who founded the Bee, realized that there was this huge, large void on the right for humor that was really biting, sarcastic, satirical, that kind of punched back at the left. You know, the left does that so well. They've owned, you know, the night shows, the late night shows, Saturday Night Live. They own everything, as you know, education, entertainment, all of that. So there was nobody really doing satire and comedy really great from the right that wasn't cheesy, you know, that wasn't just kind of silly, but was actually biting and impactful. And he felt like he had the talent and ability to do something like that. And so he started this website and it just took off. And so it just really proved that there was a void there. There was a lot of demand there because it was generating millions of page views within a matter of a couple of months. So it really took off in 2016. I got involved in 2018 and we've just been growing rapidly ever since.
Now, do you function, do you have sort of a, you know, if I think of, say, Jimmy Fallon or these guys, they typically have a little team of writers who supply jokes and then they go, let's go with this one, let's go with that one. What's the sort of process of cooking up this stuff at the Bee? Is it, do you have a handful of guys who sit around a table and you go, and whatever makes you guys laugh like crazy, that's the one that makes the cut? How do you decide on what to use? And is it a team or is it just one or two guys who does it every day?
It started out as just a couple of guys, which is impressive because we were able to take off with just a couple of creative minds, but they're very brilliant creative minds. We now have a whole team of writers. They pitch ideas all day long, and it's all headlines. You know, the joke is in the headline when you're reading satire. You really don't need to read the article. We'd like you to. We want you to. But the joke is in the headline. So we pitch those ideas back and forth all day long, and the ones that really catch on with our team, where our team is responding positively to it, and we feel like it's funny, and we're all agreeing that it's really funny, and it's hitting the right note, the right angle, those are the ones that we'll run with. So we have a process in place for kind of sifting through those and iterating on them to get them right where they're ready to be published. But it's a really fun process because we just look at the headlines every day and think, how can we do a satirical, funny take on this that just exaggerates the truth a bit to make a point? And then we just pitch that stuff all day long. So it's a fun process.
And then typically you have the headline, but you also have, I think, typically a very professionally done illustration of the point. So, for example, if you have, you know, exasperated husband is sort of responding to what the wife says, you know, you've got a picture of the guy and he's looking kind of like peeved and, you know, out of sorts. So so there's a creative process that goes, not just a verbal process, but a visually creative process. And I think you're very good at both.
Yeah, well, we have really talented people that are involved in the creative side doing the Photoshops, and we now do animated videos on YouTube. You can see on our YouTube channel. So we have some super talented people who are involved in that. But that is part of the joke, and it's one of the reasons it's interesting. You know, we've been fact-checked a lot, and there's been a lot of discussion about how our satire is too believable. And one of the ways they try to make it seem more believable than it is they divorce the headlines from the images. You know, that's part of the joke. And so sometimes they'll take the headline out of context. They rip it away from the context of our website or our Twitter feed or whatever, and they'll change up the wording, and then they'll ask people, is this believable? And of course it's believable outside of that context. But when you've got the crazy Photoshop that's involved with it, that makes it a little bit, you know, more obviously satirical.
Well, let's pause and get into this, because you just said something very striking, which is you've got a satirical site that is fact-checked by who? By Snopes? By PolitiFact? Who's fact-checking you? And doesn't the fact that they even feel the need to do that suggest that the line between what the left and the Democrats are doing and your parody of what they're doing, that's actually a fairly thin line?
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of people involved in the fact-checking. We really got dinged for the first time on Facebook because they were working with Snopes as a fact checker, and they're no longer working with Snopes in a professional relationship, but they used to use Snopes to do fact checking for stories that they felt like were misleading people. So Snopes was rating our stories false over and over and over again. Lately, it's coming from a number of places. You know, Facebook is funding a fact checking effort out of USA Today. So we get fact checked by USA Today all the time. They recently fact checked a story. Get this. We did a piece on how, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death had been overturned by the Ninth Circuit Court. And it's like her death was overturned. They fact-checked that. And it was a lengthy fact-check of our joke that cited 15 sources to prove that our joke was false. It's so silly and absurd, the length that they're going to try to refute our jokes. But I think the reason for it is pretty obvious. You know, they don't like the targets that we're aiming at. Satire is extremely effective at getting a point across. And so what they want to do is discredit us by making sure that we're basically labeled as a deceitful disinformation outfit, not a satirical outfit. And if they can do that, then they can get us off the social networks.
Well, I mean, wouldn't this be like fact-checking the Johnny Carson monologue? I mean, the absurdity of it is just it's almost like that is part of the satire itself, isn't it?
Yeah, so imagine going to a comedy show, and every time the guy tells a joke, you stand up and yell, that's false, that's not true, that's false. You know, jokes don't have a truth value. They're either funny or they're not. So what the left needs to learn to do is either laugh or not laugh at the jokes they don't like, but they're really insistent on fact-checking them. And like I said, I think there's a strategy behind that. There's a reason that they're doing that.
Yeah, well, isn't it, I remember that in the old days when you'd make jokes about feminists, you know, their general response was always, that's not funny. And it looks that trope, that's not funny, is now become generically true of the left. They can't laugh at themselves. We want to talk more with Seth Dillon. We'll come right back to ask him more about the Babylon Bee, not just what they're doing, but what they have in store. I'd like to introduce you to NutraMedics, a professional supplement brand trusted by doctors since 1993 and now available to you. NutraMedics produces high-quality, natural herbal remedies and popular supplements from nature's richest resources like the Amazon rainforest. Ingredients as pure and raw as possible. NutraMedics products provide targeted support for detoxification, the immune system, and optimum health. For me personally, I recommend RelaxMedics. A good night's sleep is hard to come by. I've never slept as well as I have since taking RelaxMedics before bed. Get 10% off by using the code Dinesh10 during checkout. The best part about NutraMedics, every year they donate a minimum of 50% of their profits to global charities and missions. That's right, 50% of profits Take it from me. Go to NutraMedics.com and order Relax Medics. You'll thank me in the morning. Go to NutraMedics.com, NutraMedics.com, and use the code Dinesh10 for 10% off. I'm back with Seth Dillon, the CEO of the Babylon Bee. Seth, we live in a time of political correctness, and isn't it true that it's difficult to have comedy when people are constantly trying to tell you how to think and what to say? But is it also true, on the other hand, that the intolerance and stuffiness of this environment creates opportunities for comedy?
Yeah, that's the challenge, isn't it? So on the one hand, it's really comical what's happening, and it's really absurd what's happening, so it's easy to make fun of. On the other hand, you're not allowed to make fun of anything. I think that one of the ways that the left has really made it difficult to do comedy lately is that they've made reality so absurd that it's difficult to satirize. So for us, that's one of the challenges, and this is an unintentional way that they're doing it. You know, political correctness, they enforce very emphatically and very deliberately. But they're also their ideas, some of these policies, some of the things that they're promoting, you know, the kind of stuff that you see in the news where there's like pole dancing happening in libraries for young children, like that kind of thing. Kids are learning to twerk in a library and their parents are present and everyone thinks it's great. This kind of stuff is so insane and so crazy and so beyond the pale that it's very difficult to satirize a society that's reached that point. So I think that's the unintentional way that they're making comedy very difficult. But yes, political correctness, of course, you know, there's a lot of comedians who've chimed in on this. Bill Maher, Jerry Seinfeld won't even do stand-up shows on college campuses anymore because college kids have been conditioned to think that everything is offensive. They're so ready to be offended by everything that they're not willing to laugh at anything. And we have to, as comedians, we have to continually keep pushing back against that and keep making the jokes that people don't want us to make, so that people learn to laugh again.
Well, I'm just thinking of, like, you know, what would George Carlin do today, or any of these guys, Richard Pryor? They'd be run off the stage because their whole idea was to challenge existing taboos and orthodoxies and go in your face about them, and that's just unacceptable today. Now, one thing I noticed that the Bee does, which I think is really cool, is you're not just focusing on the left. You'll turn the camera around on conservative culture. You made fun of Trump, of Trumpsters and their peculiarities. But you also made fun of the church. It seems like you've got a very good understanding of the sort of culture of the church, including things like, you know, turning off the mic of the backup singer. And one of your regular targets is Joel Osteen and his sort of theological problems. You know, I like the one where you have a little meme about the fact that his theology check light keeps going on, and it's really annoying to him because he's constantly veering off the biblical reservation, so to speak. So part of it, are you trying to teach Christians to laugh at themselves?
Yes, the church needs laughter. I think, you know, we need levity everywhere. I think everybody is taking themselves too seriously, but it happens everywhere. The Babylon Bee was originally created as a Christian satire site, you know, run by Christians, and we do a lot of this Christian living, evangelical Christian culture humor. A lot of those are inside jokes that people outside of those circles aren't going to understand. We do the broader political stuff too, but it doesn't matter what the topic is. I think it's very healthy to take your own beliefs, the you know, the things that are your sacred cows, and throw them up on the wall with a projector. Take a look at them. See if we're okay with some of the things that we're really believing. See if we're guilty of hypocrisy ourselves. I think that self-deprecating humor is extremely valuable, just in keeping people from taking themselves too seriously. So, the church needs it. Everybody needs it. And I think it's one of the things that the Babylon Bee does well that's so refreshing. It's one of the reasons I wanted to get involved in the first place, was because I thought the self-deprecating humor was so healthy.
What's a way to take what you're doing now and take it to the next level? What are some things that you're hatching, some ideas you're thinking about to go beyond the satirical headlines and memes and even the satirical articles? Is there a way, for example, to create a comedy channel for young people? In other words, to create the opportunities for young comedians who may not be able to go get their teeth cut at the improv, who probably are not going to be invited by Kimmel to come on his show. What is the way in which the Babylon Bee can create an almost alternative universe for comedy? Where can we take this?
Well, you know, that would be a great goal. I think that, we're focused day to day on just continuing to do what we do really well. And then we'll kind of naturally grow in the direction that we're already moving in. And I think that, you know, figuring out precisely where that's going to be a few years from now, when people ask me 5 years from now, where are we going to be? I'm not exactly sure how to answer that, but I would love to be having more of an impact in other areas, getting into video and things like that. That would be great if we had, and also, like you said, if we could provide a platform for other types of comedians who are doing the politically incorrect comedy, the jokes that they're not allowed to say, the wrong thing that's not allowed to come out of their mouths. You know, that would be really awesome, I think, and very impactful. The difficulty is going to be having platforms to do that from. So, you know, we still reach our audience primarily through Facebook, through Twitter, through Instagram. And our standing on those platforms is rather tentative, as you're probably aware. And, all the fact checking and all of the attacks that are coming from the left. And now the New York Times has recently called us, they've said that we're a far right misinformation site that traffics in misinformation under the guise of satire, like we're pretending to be satirists. You know, that kind of stuff is a real threat to our platform itself. So we've taken some steps to try to shore ourselves up against those threats and bring on, you know, subscribers who are supporting us directly. But it's really that platform itself that is very, you know, conservatives have to be fighting for their right to be on these platforms and to keep their voices heard. So we're on the front lines of that battle. And that's taking up a lot of our time and attention at the moment.
I mean, I think the good news, Seth, is that there are half dozen new platforms that are being cooked up that are going to come at us in the next couple of months from all kinds of different directions. I mean, I'm happy to see Parler's back up. Mike Lindell is starting his own platform called Frank. Apparently, the Trumps are cooking something up. So, in a weird way, the stifling effect of the digital censors has been to provoke conservatives to say, okay, well, listen, guys, you know, we're going to stay on your platforms as long as we can, but in the meantime, we're going to cultivate our own. And quite frankly, there's going to be a time not too far from now when we're not going to really need you anymore.
Right. Right. And the question will just remain, you know, like what happened with Parler, where they got taken off of, basically wiped off the internet. It'll be challenging to see how conservative platforms that are built as alternatives to these kind of mainstream large platforms that seem to be invincible and aren't subject to the same types of penalties that platforms like Parler are. It remains to be seen how those sites are going to really stand on their own 2 feet. Do they need their own servers? You know, what kind of infrastructure is required for them to do that, to make that work? How do they get into the App Store? How can it be accessible on phones? You know, these are big fights that conservatives have coming up. So, you know, Parler's on the front lines for that one right now. It'll be interesting to see what happens with them.
Seth, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast. This has been a very enlightening conversation, folks. I highly recommend the Babylon Bee. It's a laugh a day, or more than a laugh a day. Really fun stuff, and you'll get addicted to it as I am. When I want the truth about the left and its dangerous agenda, I don't really turn to the fake news media. I turn to my good friends at Capital Research Center. We go way back. I've known Capital Research Center's president, Scott Walter, since we were young conservatives just starting out in Washington. I love to let people know about their work, which is comprehensive, reliable, and hard-hitting. Capital Research Center exposes the ugly truth about the left like no one else can or will. My Capital Research Center friends zero in on the big money funders, the radical activists, and the hateful ideology guiding today's leftists. To get the details, go to their website, capitalresearch.org/Dinesh. There you'll get a chance to obtain your free copy of a recent Capital Research Center investigative report that revealed how Facebook billionaire Mark Zuckerberg basically bought last year's election for the left. This research raised eyebrows. It's already driven much-needed reform in Georgia and Arizona. Let's hope that other states follow. So check out Capital Research Center and their hard-hitting investigations. Visit capitalresearch.org/Dinesh. You'll be glad you did. One of the questions that many of us think about and sometimes agonize about as parents is, how do we pass on our faith, our religious beliefs, to our children? How do we ensure, if we can, that our children take those beliefs and make them their own? Because at some point, children become adults, they go out into the world, they have to think for themselves. So what can we do as parents to make it more likely that our children will believe the way that we do? this is a huge problem in our culture. Many children of Christian parents are falling away from the faith. They're becoming part of secular culture. Our culture in general has become not only secular, but increasingly secular. Church attendance, church membership, those things seem to be slipping. And there's an important book by sociologist Christian Smith, one of the terrific authorities in this field. He used to be, I think he still is, at Notre Dame. He has an important book. It's called Handing Down the Faith, in which he discusses exactly this. What are the things you can do to make your children believe as you do? And he says that there is a piece of good news and challenging news, perhaps bad news, up front. And that is that the parents' views have the most dramatic impact of any institution on the religious formation of their children. Parents matter. He says parents matter more than religious congregations, more than youth groups, more than faith-based schools, more than missions and service trips, more than summer camps, more than youth pastors, more than Sunday school. All those things put together don't matter as much as the parents. Now, that's challenging because it means that if parents are ho-hum, lackadaisical, neglect the religious formation of their children, well, they shouldn't be surprised when their children go another way. They go off in a different direction. Now, the most important things that parents can do, says Christian Smith, is to exhibit and articulate your religious beliefs in ordinary life. Exhibit them, meaning practice them, live them. But number two, live them not just habitually or periodically on Sunday. Oh, it's Sunday, we all have to go to church. But talk about your faith, live it in the week, in ordinary life. Your children have to see that your faith is an integral part of your ordinary life. And then they'll see it's important to you. It matters. This isn't just something that you do one day out of seven or you do out of custom. This is something you do because you care. You believe you're vested in it. It's not compartmentalized. It's a part of who you are. That is a critically important thing. The second thing that Christian Smith recommends, which I think is very interesting, is he says that parents should exhibit what he calls an authoritative, not authoritarian, but authoritative parenting style. An authoritative parenting style has two complementary attributes. First, parents set firm standards, firm rules, firm expectations, firm guidelines. This is the way things ought to be. And parents are demanding about that. You must follow these rules because they are our rules and they are just rules. But the second thing is, and this is important, it goes along with it, that parents enforce the rules in a supportive, warm, and loving atmosphere. Now, this shows the child that you are serious about the rules, but also that you love them, which is to say that the rules are for their benefit. If you divorce these two aspects and you're, let's say, authoritarian but not warm and loving, then the child basically begins to see you as a kind of a tyrant. It's your way because you're more powerful, because you're the parent and you're supporting the household, so what you say goes. And so the rule isn't accepted as a just rule. It's simply respected because you made it and you have the power to enforce it. And similarly, parents who are warm and loving but don't set standards make the opposite mistake. And the opposite mistake basically is to tell your child that I'm going to be warm and loving, but I don't really care what path you choose. It's not important to me. Go your own way. I'm going to be sort of a cheerleader for whatever choices you make. And this kind of permissive and some sort of promiscuous parenting, very common in our own day where the parents are, you know, taking the lead of the children, this, says Christian Smith, is not a good way to make sure that your children continue in your religious path. And finally, Christian Smith recommends a third recommendation, which he calls channeling. And this is where the parent exercises his or her influence, or both of their influence, in trying to make sure that the environment that your children move in is one that is hospitable to the faith. And so how do you do this? Well, says Christian Smith, you do it in two ways. The first is that you make sure that there are other adults in your child's life who they can also relate to, who also care about the faith. This is not to say that children are not allowed to raise questions and doubts. There should be a supportive atmosphere to do that. But when children see that it's not merely their parents who believe and everybody else thinks differently and thinks their parents are kooks, no, there's an uncle here and a friend there and a neighbor here, and they too. So in other words, parents choose your friends and acquaintances carefully so that your children can see that there's a multiplicity of adults who are engaged in this enterprise together. And then says Christian Smith, and this is his final recommendation, he says parents should keep an eye on who your child's friends are and use your influence, again, in a kind of gentle, guiding way to try to make sure that your children have friends who are themselves committed in a religious sense, who are themselves people who take moral issues and religious issues seriously. Why? Because then what the peer group does reinforces what the parents have already planted. So the parents are the key planters of the seed. The parents actually are the main influence, not the peer group. But when the peer group is in sync with the parents, then the child is very likely to feel that both from his elders or her elders or from peers, you're getting kind of reinforcing messages. And this is all going to enable the child at some point to do what all children must do, which is that they can't simply say, I believe because my parents do. They're going to have to say, I believe because I've chosen to. I believe because this is the path I want for my life. And what a joy it is for parents who are anchored in the faith that they believe to be true and to be eternal to see their child in the end making that same choice for themselves. My podcast is sponsored by Dr. Douglas Howard and his incredible team at Balance of Nature. This is important for you to know because I want you to discover what I did. You must eat your fruits and vegetables. If you're not getting enough fruits and vegetables, you're not as healthy as you can be. Your immune system won't be as strong as it should be, and you're not going to ward off the bad stuff like your body should. Those six little Balance of Nature capsules ensure you get the equivalent of 10 daily servings of fruits and veggies. Give your immune system a fighting chance. Balance of Nature ensures you get the nutrients into your body that are essential to maintain your health and vitality. That's why I'm religious about taking my daily capsules, and so should you. Join me and experience the Balance of Nature difference for yourself. For a limited time, all new preferred customers will receive an additional 35% discount and free shipping on your first Balance of Nature order. Use discount code AMERICA. Call 800-246-8751 or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code AMERICA. It's time for our mailbox question. By the way, if you want to send questions, please do, audio or video preferable. Send them to questiondinesh@gmail.com. Let's go to today's question. Listen.
Hey, Dinesh. Thanks for considering my question. I'm a former resident of California, currently of North Carolina, and I'm so glad I moved. I'm a big fan. I've enjoyed a couple of your movies, and I enjoy your video/podcast just about every day. My question to you is very simple. Would you please share with us the testimony of how you came to Christ? And also, if you have any written resources that detail that at length, I'd love to hear it, to have you share them with us. Thanks again for taking my question, and keep up the good work, my friend.
Wow, I wasn't quite ready to give a testimony, but I'll just say a few things briefly. I was raised Catholic in India, so I was part of a small Christian minority in India. My family is originally from Goa, which was a Portuguese colony. And the Portuguese converted the Goans. So they were probably originally Hindu. They became Catholics. They took the last name of typically the missionary who converted them. The Christianity I was raised in was sort of a formulaic kind of go to mass on Sunday, conventional type of Christianity. So I was a believer, but I was somewhat of a tepid believer, somewhat of a habitual believer, you might say. I hadn't really made my faith my own, and I didn't infuse the ordinary functioning of my life until I came to America. It was only in adult life that I experienced for the first time, this was in California, evangelical Christianity through the Calvary Chapel Church movement in California. These are, by the way, these were sort of hippies for Jesus in the 60s and 70s. They're not quite that way now, but they have a little bit of the hippie style. I began to experience the Christianity going to these churches in California that was all about a relationship with Christ. So not just a series of propositions, not just a series of liturgies or sacraments, but a Christianity rooted in the experience of God and Christ, and a Christianity that would infuse all aspects of life and not simply something that you kind of do on Sunday. I began to then think about Christianity more seriously. And then when the new atheism came along in the 2007-2008, I jumped into the field of Christian apologetics. Why? Because I thought it was really important to defend really a non-denominational Christianity. I'd call it a C.S. Lewis Christianity, mere Christianity, and defend it in secular culture. So that's what my apologetics work is about. I wrote three books in that area, all of which I'd recommend. The first one, one of the books I'm most proud of, What's So Great About Christianity. That's the book that's probably the one I would recommend you start with. Then Life After Death, The Evidence, which came a couple of years later. And a third book called What's So Good About God, which is really more about God and suffering. And taken together, those reflect not just personal testimony, but I would say detailed arguments that show why faith makes sense, offers an explanation for the world, and offers an explanation for our place in the world, and also the life to come. It's all in there, and I'd recommend those as an expression of my faith and the arguments for it.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.